Goswami Maharaj, Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai. Om Vishnu Pada Paramahansa Pribhraj, Akacharya Stota, Saraswati Shri Shri Maharaj, Devangir, Shri Bhakti Siddhanta, Saraswati Thakur Maharaj, Prabhupada Ki Jai. Nana Dikori Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai. Jiskan Founder Acharya Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai. Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur Ki Jai. Premsa Gaho Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Radhigarara Sri Vasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gogina Sham Kundarada Kundigi Govatam Ki Jai. Shri Shri Vrindavan Dham Ki Jai. Shri Shri Navritam Ki Jai. Shri Shri Mayapuram Ki Jai. Shri Shri Mathura Dham Ki Jai. Shri Shri Jagannathpuri Dham Ki Jai. Shri Shri Ayodhya Dham Ki Jai. Tulasi Devi Ki Jai. Bhakti Devi Ki Jai. Gangamaya Ki Jai. Jivanamaya Ki Jai. Gaur Premanandi Ki Jai. Harinama Sankirtan Ki Jai. Shri Shri Brihad Pradanga Ki Jai. Transcendental Prasadam Distribution Ki Jai. Shri Shri Gaurnitai Ki Jai. Shri Shri Karan Yatra Ki Jai. Shamaveta Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Shri Shri Guru and Shri Gauranga.
Maybe English speaker, we don't have another one, so we have to go.
Maybe some other English book, yeah.
Bhagavatam,
anything.
Anything English in the house?
Oh, I have my Chaitanya Chaitanya.
Anything here? Oh, this is it. He has his own.
So I was reading some nice verses in the Chaitanya Chaitamrita, so on the way here. Oh, I'm sorry. Just like the United Nations. Instant translation. Trouble is, I don't speak English either.
New York?
American.
You speak New York?
New York. New York, they say Earl instead of oil. Do you have that Krishna vision number 4?
Yeah.
No, I just wanted to know. You heard that? It's good, isn't it? Krishna Prema did a nice service. You going to translate? Okay. So I'm going to... I'm sorry I'm late, by the way. It was my fault because, first of all, I had a little injury, so that slows things up. And this morning, I received a fax from California. Dhruva Karma and I are about to see our book published by the VBT in America. It's North American VBT. It's called Divine Nature, A Spiritual Perspective on the Environmental Crisis. And it's kind of like coming back in the higher taste in that genre of book. So they're about to print it. And anyway, the cover came on the fax, the cover artwork, and it wasn't quite exactly what I wanted, so I had to spend 2 or 3 hours writing a fax to go back to ask them to change the picture a little bit. It's very complicated when you try to describe a picture with words, how you want it to look. So that took a long time. I'm very sorry. Anyway, we got very delayed, so I hope you'll forgive me. I suppose your guests already left hours ago, is that right? Yeah? The other guests? They went home. Anyway. So these are some verses in the 7th chapter of Adi Lila. You might remember, you may know, that Srila Prabhupada had this particular chapter translated early on, before the actual Chaitanya Chaitamrita was completely done, because it's a very nice chapter. It talks about the Panchatattva and Lord Chaitanya's conversion of the Mayavadis under Prakasananda Saraswati and Benares, and why he took sannyas. So in the beginning there's some nice verses about how the Panchatattva was, and Lord Chaitanya in particular, were very merciful to the conditioned souls, even more so than Krishna himself. So they didn't consider if a person was offensive or what the person's background was, but they simply distributed love of God indiscriminately and accepted people from all backgrounds. And this describes some of that from the scriptural point of view, why they, Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda, thought that way. So there's a description of the great flood of love of God that began from the Panchatattva. It's compared to a flood. This metaphor is used a lot in Vedic literature, how there's great oceans and floods. The material world, for example, is talked about as a great ocean. Samashritaye parapalava pravam, great vast ocean. It's also described by Maharaj Parikit, by Sukadev to Maharaj Parikit in the Srimad Bhagavatam as Kaleter dosha nid hey rajam astiye kumas. Now that the age of Kali is a great ocean of false, simply false. And the great ocean of material existence is said to be something that is full of miseries, and yet samashritaye parapalava pravam, one takes shelter of the boat of the lotus feet of the Lord, who is the sustainer of the cosmic manifestation and the enemy of the Mura demon, then that great ocean, which is ordinarily an ocean, is compared to the small pond of water that fills the footprint of a calf. For such persons, their goal is Vaikuntha, or the place where there is no anxiety, not the place of danger, where there is danger at every step. So these are some of the analogies or metaphors. You use the word ocean or big bodies of water. So in regard to the Panchatattva, Krishnadas Kaviraj talks about the great ocean, the inundation of love of God, how it inundated the whole world, and how it would in the future inundate, even beyond the world, that it would actually ripple out into the corners of the universe. Just as when you drop something in a lake or body of water, the waves ripple all the way to the shore. So it's described that when there is water flooding something, if there are seeds, the seeds during an inundation, they become impotent. And they fructify when the water kind of subsides and recedes, and there's just the earth there to germinate them. Anyway, this description of the great flood of the ocean of love of God is such that those who have material desires, or the seeds of material desires, we might say, are rendered impotent by the great flood of water, and they cannot sprout and seed and grow and fructify properly. So this great inundation of love of God brings with it the subsiding of material desires, because it's so powerful and so enveloping, just like an ocean. When I was a child, I saw a movie of a tidal wave, somehow Hollywood stuff, I don't know how they did it, but we were supposedly watching the city of Hong Kong. There was a great tidal wave, and the great, huge waves just rushed in between the buildings and swept all the cars and all the people up, and everything just got completely inundated. So it's a very appropriate metaphor analogy, because we can see how, even in places that would ordinarily not be reached, Krishna consciousness has gone there. There were some pictures I saw of some Eskimos reading Back to Godhead. They were holding a magazine upside down. But they were very amused. They liked it a lot. They were listening to the chanting. And in tribal peoples in parts of Africa, too, we saw that they became very enchanted. They began to dance and sing. They loved the kirtan. So in places where one would never think Krishna consciousness might reach,
had reached into the jails of Russia and the little townships that are around Durban and so on. Krishna comes like a great ocean. And gradually, by that inundation, these material desires are rendered impotent, or they can't fructify. So that's the power. The ocean's also very powerful. You know, when we saw this tidal wave, this illusion of a tidal wave. And of course, real tidal waves happen, but they just sweep everything away. Very powerful. We don't sometimes realize how powerful water is. Of course, any of you who've tried surfing, you know, don't want to mess around with the ocean. But it's very, very powerful. It's irresistible. When a big wave comes, you can't avoid it. You're going to get swept away. You can't hold on to anything. It's extremely powerful. That's the laws of physics. So this great law, great wave of transcendental love that's issuing from the Panchatattva is very, very, very powerful. And of course, it was predicted by Bhaktivinoda Thakur that people from all over the world, of all different persuasions and religious confessions, including Mohammedans, they would assemble in Mayapur. And we saw that nice picture that one of the Italian devotees painted. It shows some sheikhs in their sheikh outfits, all taking part in a huge kirtan with other peoples of all different backgrounds and colors and shapes and nationalities, chanting Gaur Hari and Jai Satchinanda. That was predicted. So that's part of this great ocean. It was predicted that it would envelop and include all the peoples of the world, and all races and all nationalities, and they would become completely like swimming, like fish in that great ocean. So this verse says, it's a little bit for me to read also. Uchala prema vanya chaudike vedai stri vidda balaka yuva sabare duvai. The flood of love of God swelled in all directions. And thus, young men, old men, women and children were all immersed in that inundation. Prabhupada's purport. When the contents of the storehouse of love of Godhead is thus distributed, there is a powerful inundation which covers the entire land. In Sridhar Mayapur, there is sometimes a great flood after the rainy season. Actually, there is a flood almost every year. At least it covers the garden in Mayapur. Every year they have to replant all those flowers. It's such a big flood. It's inconceivable where all that water comes from. This is part of the great mystery, even of the material world, and seeing these great oceans or even great rivers. If you've ever been up to the Gangotri or the, what's it called, Gormukh, the mouth there of the Ganga, it's inconceivable how much water comes out of there to comprehend how it's coming night and day, continuously, 24 hours. Just gushing this big pillar of water. Or in any big river, you can see constantly, every day, 24 hours a day, billions of gallons of liters of water. Just, it's mystical. You actually can't calculate it or comprehend it. And to think that it's all going back up into the sky through evaporation and several billions of many, many billions of liters of water are floating up there. They're just floating up in the sky all the time. Floating. Billions of tons of water. It's just floating up there every day. And then it's coming back down, and then it's flowing through these huge rivers, billions of liters and tons into the ocean, and the cycle is just going on. It's actually inconceivable. We can't even begin to conceive how vast this very planet is. This little tiny mustard seed and bag of mustard seed. It's so vast, it's so inconceivable to understand how big it is. I was reading the other day about oil. Yes, sometimes we think that there's only a limited amount of oil. And, of course, this is a little digression, but once Prabhupada was asked about the limitations of oil. There was a Lord Queensberry in his room in London in 1976, it was. And he was a kind of an environmentalist, and he kept asking Prabhupada, how long can we go on exploiting the oil? It's a bit dangerous, isn't it? And Prabhupada said, when the earth runs out of oil, it will fall out of its orbit. And he just looked at him like he was astonished. And then he said, it's not so hard to understand. He said, it's just like an airplane. When an airplane's flying and it runs out of petroleum, it's going to fall down. Do you understand? Yeah. So, it's anyway, we were trying to compute after. I was like, how does that work? Anyway, you know, maybe there's a gyroscopic effect and, you know, it gets unbalanced when so much oil comes out, and because it's not properly balanced in the orbit, it strays out of its orbit and so on and so forth. But anyway, what I was going to say is that I was reading that there's so much oil in parts of the world that haven't been really mined yet that they predict it's going to be around for 40, 50, some people say 60, some say 100 more years. It's billions of gallons are coming out of there every week. Billions of gallons. Where is it all coming from? Somehow it's there. Of course, we also understand that Mother Bhumi can supply unlimitedly because she's the mother and we're all her sons and daughters. And just like a pregnant mother, she can supply enough milk for any number of children. So from that philosophical perspective, Mother Bhumi, the earth and its bounty, can supply unlimited foodstuffs and jewels and cures and medicines for any number of people actually on the planet. And it's when the situation becomes disturbed, as has happened, as we read in the Bhagavatam, that sometimes a Mother Bhumi withholds her supply. But anyway, I was just elaborating a bit on how mystical the very planet we walk on is. We can't imagine how great it is. There's something Sir Isaac Newton, I think he was the founder of the Royal Society as well, said, it's a famous quote, Prabhupada kind of paraphrased it once. He was a great scientist of his day, and I think he founded the Royal Society as well, and so many things, Sir Isaac Newton. So he's known for saying that I stand on the bank of the great ocean and I pick a few grains of sand up in my hand and let them go. And people praise me as being very advanced, a great thinker, a great scientist. When I pick up these grains of sand and realize how many more grains of sand there are on this beach and all the other beaches just of this planet, I realize how little I know, that I know practically nothing. So Prabhupada used to paraphrase that to give us the idea that we may know little about something, but actually we know very little. And when it comes to spiritual knowledge, we may know a little, but actually Krishna is so vast that we can never reach the end of knowing about Krishna. Never, ever, ever. Even Lord Ananta is chanting the glories of Krishna about all his different activities with all his thousands of heads. He never repeats himself. And he's been chanting since time immemorial, and he will chant forever, and he will never repeat himself. So that's how vast Krishna is. And Krishna is so vast and so blissful that he becomes desirous to taste his own happiness, and therefore he incarnates as Lord Chaitanya and takes on this dual form of the Lord himself and his devotee, Radharani. And of course, this is, as mentioned in this chapter, the merciful form of the Lord. He doesn't consider the offenses, therefore he is Namo Mahavajanyaya, Krishna Prema Kadayate. So Prabhupada comments on this verse about the inundation, saying, when the contents of the storehouse of love of God is thus distributed, there is a powerful inundation which covers the entire land. In Tridhammayapur, there is sometimes a great flood after the rainy season. This is an indication that from the birthplace of Lord Chaitanya, the inundation of love of God should be spread all over the world. For this will help everyone, including old men, young men, women, and children. The Krishna consciousness movement of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is so powerful that it can inundate the entire world and interest all classes of men on the subject of love of God. Then, Sajjana Durjana Pangu Jara Andagam Prema Vanyaya Duvaila Jagdera Jam Jagdera Jam. The Krishna consciousness movement will inundate the entire world and drown everyone, whether one be a gentleman, a rogue, or even lame, invalid, or blind. Here again, it may be emphasized that although jealous rascals protest that Europeans and Americans cannot be given the sacred thread or sannyas, there is no need even to consider whether one is a gentleman or a rogue, because this is a spiritual movement which is not concerned with the external body of skin and bones. Because it is being properly conducted under the guidance of the Panchatattva, strictly following the regulated principles, it has nothing to do with external impediments. So,
These prophetic words of Srila Prabhupada were written quite some time ago. And, I mean, by our standards, maybe 18 years ago. And in the years following that, we've seen that this is actually the case. Beyond our ability to understand when we saw it happen, we could realize the truth in these words. And we have seen that in many parts of the world there have been great impediments. In Australia, there was a time when the devotees, every time they'd go out on the street to chant, they would be arrested for either obstructing the street, walking, what do they call it, obstruction of the footpath, obstruction of people walking, or just invading people's privacy by making too much noise. So they were put in jail again and again, and they had amassed huge fines, coming to some $40,000, and they weren't paying them. Because Prabhupada had instructed the devotees, he said, I've told in a lecture, he said this, I heard it, he said, I've instructed my disciples, when they go to jail for Harinam Sankirtan, they shouldn't give even one penny. They should just stay in the jail and chant Hare Krishna. So he gave the devotees that instruction, and they carried it out, and they never paid, and then they were always released, usually after some overnight stay. And finally, they, by continuously doing it and preaching very nicely, they became accepted. And today in Australia, they have a very good reputation among the police and the government and even the different religions and the academics and people in general, the media. They're very, actually very much appreciated. So this is one of many examples of how devotees, because they were strictly following the orders of Prabhupada, the spiritual master, their vows of Sankirtan, and just keeping to the original practices of the Panchatattva and all of Lord Chaitanya's followers and the instructions of Lord Chaitanya himself, they overcame all these very atheistic objections from people who were meat eaters and breaking all the regulative principles. They came to appreciate the devotees. And so they've been very successful ever since then. And the next verse. When the five members of the Panchatattva saw the entire world drowned in love of Godhead and the seed of material enjoyment in the living entities completely destroyed, they all became exceedingly happy. Purport. In this connection, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur writes in his Anubhasya that since the living entities all belong to the marginal potency of the Lord, each and every living entity has a natural tendency to become Krishna conscious, although at the same time the seed of material enjoyment is undoubtedly within him. The seed of material enjoyment, watered by the course of material nature, fructifies to become a tree of material entanglement which endows the living entity with all kinds of material enjoyment. To enjoy such material facilities is to be afflicted with the three material miseries. Prabodhananda Saraswati writes in his Chaitanya Chandamrita that when influenced by Lord Chaitanya's Krishna consciousness movement, materialists become averse to talking about their own wives and children. Supposedly learned scholars give up their tedious studies of Vedic literature. Yogis give up their impractical practices of mystic yoga. Ascetics give up their austere activities of penance and austerity. And sannyasis give up their study of Sankhya philosophy. Thus, they are all attracted to the bhakti yoga practice of Lord Chaitanya and cannot relish a mellow taste superior to that of Krishna consciousness. Then, yata yata prema vrishti kare pancha jan tatta tatta badhe jala vyape tribhuvan. The more the five members of the Panchatattva caused the rains of love of God to fall, the more the inundation increases and spreads all over the world. Purport. The Krishna consciousness movement is not stereotyped or stagnant. It will spread all over the world in spite of objections by fools and rascals that Europeans and American mileches cannot be accepted as Brahmins or sannyasis. Here it is indicated that this process will spread and inundate the entire world with Krishna consciousness. So Lord Chaitanya was, in his meditation, also realized that some persons would go way out of their way, like impersonalists and learned scholars and certain yogis, to avoid the Krishna consciousness movement. So he thought very deeply how this could be combated, how this could be confronted, and how they could also be attracted to Krishna consciousness. Now, it is also said in the fourth chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, the first canto, when Sudha Goswami was taking his seat to speak to the great sages of Vaisharanya, he was being offered a seat of respect as being the eldest member of the assembly. And according to the Vaishnava etiquette, he was given an elevated seat. And he was about to speak to Bhagavatam. Because he was about to speak to Bhagavatam, he was given an elevated seat. And he was not only going to speak to Bhagavatam, but he was going to speak spiritual knowledge according to the time and the place and the circumstance and the audience present. In the verse's purport, Prabhupada mentions how Sudha Goswami was given a seat according to his position. He was going to speak very high philosophy. So it was appropriate for the sages, and many were there from all over the world and different parts of the universe, in fact, that he would be given an elevated seat because he was going to speak to them as someone who was going to relate Srimad Bhagavatam. So in that purport, Prabhupada writes that one should speak according to one's realization. That is, one may, as the speaking of Sukadeva, who was the actual speaker of the Bhagavatam, was once described as speaking as far as his realization would account or would allow. And the analogy was used of the bird, it can fly as far as it can in the sky. So one should speak, according to that logic, as far as one's realization makes it possible. So in the purport, Prabhupada says that Sudha Goswami would speak without changing the original text. In other words, he would keep the original spiritual purity of the text. Now, it's also described in the Srimad Bhagavatam that Sukadeva Goswami, the speaker of the Bhagavatam, spoke another Bhagavatam on the planets of the Gandharvas, in which he spoke 1.5 million verses. So, obviously, speakers like him, who is the speaker of the Bhagavatam, will sometimes speak some different words according to the audience, according to the situation. We can understand if that many millions and a half verses were spoken, there were some words that weren't the same as in the Bhagavatam that we read. So he was speaking according to time, place, and circumstance. And Prabhupada writes there in that purport that the speaker of Bhagavatam should speak without changing the original text, and yet at the same time he should speak in an interesting manner according to the time, place, and circumstance to ensure the listening of the audience. But he said it is very important that the original purport, the original purpose of the text should not be altered or changed, and no extraneous meaning should be screwed out of it. Those are the words Prabhupada used, screwed out of it. In other words, you shouldn't speculate or make up something that's not real. This, Prabhupada goes on to say, is realization. Realization means speaking without changing the original text, but yet speaking according to the situation so that the message will have effect. So Lord Chaitanya was also, since he is the personification of all knowledge and the perfect preacher of Vedic knowledge, meditated on how to capture these people who were very expert in avoiding, very, very expert in avoiding Krishna consciousness. There is always a class of people who will demonstrate expertise in avoiding Krishna consciousness. We'll see that when we chant Hari Nam, that almost everybody is amused and many people stop and watch. But there's a certain minority of people who just run the other way. They don't want to have anything to do with it. So Lord Chaitanya wanted to envelop all these people as well. So he decided that since at that time, at that particular place, people were very respectful to men of orange cloth. So at the age of 24, after his careful meditation, he decided that he would take the renounced order of life because people in that part of the world at that time would respect and listen to and take seriously the words of the sannyas, the mendicant. So at that very young age of 24, he took sannyas from Keshava Bharati, who was an impersonalist sannyasi, just to delude, we might say, or induce even the impersonalists to hear him and to accept him as speaking truthfully. So he went to that great extreme at a very young age, taking from a Mayavadi, took sannyas, because
according to the situation, he considered it an emergency. He wanted everybody, even those who were very skillful at avoiding the Krishna consciousness process, to have the benefit and to be able to engage in Krishna consciousness with their minds by hearing submissively. Of course, he was a very powerful pundit, and even before that time, when he was present, the great logicians, it was also part of the time, place, and circumstance in India that if you were defeated in an argument, you had to submit to the person who defeated you and more or less become his disciple. So when he would appear in Navadvipa, these envious scholars, even as students especially, they would run the other way. They would flee in every direction because they knew if they had to debate with him, they would lose and they would have to surrender. So that was how they were very expert in avoiding the actual mercy of Lord Chaitanya. So in this way, he meditated on the situation and he took that step, which made his mother very, very unhappy. Very unhappy. Of course, he let her continue to serve him through cooking prasadam. But he carried on, I'll just read the purport to what Prabhupada says about his taking sannyas. Thus the students, infidels, fruitive workers, and critics all came to surrender unto the lotus feet of the Lord. The verse was that after accepting sannyas, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu attracted the attention of all those who had evaded him, beginning with the logicians. So this was his plan. As inconceivably, it happened. They all came to surrender. We can imagine they all came to surrender to the lotus feet of the Lord, how different things were at that time. Just because he's wearing a sannyas cloth, people would come and surrender. Then the next text says, Lord Chaitanya excused them all, and they emerged into the ocean, again it's the ocean, of devotional service, for no one can escape the unique loving network of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Then this is Prabhupada's report. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is an ideal acharya. An acharya is an ideal teacher who knows the purpose of the revealed scriptures, behaves exactly according to their injunctions, and teaches his students to adopt those principles also. As an ideal acharya, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu devised ways to capture all kinds of atheists and materialists. Every acharya has a specific means of propagating the spiritual movement with the aim of bringing men to Krishna consciousness. Therefore, the method of one acharya may be different from that of another, but the ultimate goal is never neglected. Rupa Goswami comments, Yena Tena Prakratena Prakarena Mana Krishna Niveshaya Sarve Vidhi Nisheda Sur Eta Yoreva Kinkara. An acharya should devise a means by which people may somehow or other come to Krishna consciousness. So sometimes Prabhupada translates this verse as by any means. Here he's saying somehow or other. One who is an acharya, and in one sense everyone is an acharya, because an acharya is someone who teaches by an example. And Prabhupada used to say that we should tax our brains. In that last verse of the fifth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Yoginam api sarvesham abhyatanam tadatmana shradhavan bhajate yoma samayukta mamataha. Prabhupada says in a lecture, this is the verse that says of all yogis, the bhakti yoga, yogi is the highest. He says, this is a chapter on mind control, how we control the mind. That if you want to really control the mind, he said the secret of controlling the mind is to tax our brains constantly. Tax our brains, how we can spread the Krishna consciousness movement. What method, what system can I adopt to spread Krishna consciousness? This is yena tena prakarena mana Krishna nidishaya. Somehow, by any means, somehow or other, figure out a way to do it. And Lord Chaitanya will help you. Here's an interesting... I'll just read one last thing here because I thought it was interesting. The acharya must devise a means to bring them to devotional service. Prabhupada is really talking about himself here.
First, they should become Krishna conscious, and all prescribed rules and regulations may gradually be later introduced. In our Krishna consciousness movement, we follow this policy of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. For example, since boys and girls in the Western countries freely intermingle, special concessions regarding their customs and habits are necessary to bring them to Krishna consciousness. The Acharya must devise a means to bring them to devotional service. Therefore, although I am a sannyasi, sometimes I take part. Position to the Vedic traditions and principles and standards. So, because it's so late, I'll stop here, and maybe you might have some questions or comments to make. Krishna can do anything. Yes, Krishna, like Lord Chaitanya, never leaves his original place, but he also manifests his eternal otherworldly Goloka pastimes in different parts of the material world at different times. So that, of course, is achincha. It's inconceivable. We can't even conceive how a yogi can be in 5, 6, or 7 places at once. It's not possible. But because Vedic literature is infallible, we still accept it. We can accept even things that are very difficult, like we didn't go to the moon. Some people left the Krishna consciousness movement because they didn't believe we didn't go to the moon. So, Vedic knowledge is called Shabda. There's different means of perception. Pratyaksha, Anuma, that's hypothesis, direct perception, and perception through the eyes and understanding of authorities. And of course, as one enters onto the path of Krishna consciousness, begins to understand that there are phenomena which are beyond our perception. Even the concept of Veda, Veda Tattva is described as achincha. It's actually inconceivable, even though we have to deal with it every day, that we are simultaneously one and different from Krishna. So that is called achincha Veda, Veda Tattva. That's the first teaching of Lord Chaitanya to Sanatana Goswami. This is our original position, that we're detached to Shakti, marginal potency, simultaneously one and different from Krishna. Prabhupada told us a story once when he was at a place with Dr. Mishra. Dr. Mishra was one of the Indian, what do you call them, when they go from one country to another, expats. He was like an Indian expat staying in America. So, He gave Prabhupada some shelter and let him stay in his home. He was a bit of an impersonalist. But you might have read about him in a book about Prabhupada Lilamrita, Dr. Mishra. So Prabhupada was at a summer camp with a few small group of us in 1966. And some of the people they were trying to promote Dr. Mishra's philosophy. And one of the things was that I'm a bubble, make me the sea. That was his philosophy. I am a bubble, like a bubble in the ocean. Make me the sea.
So the bubble would merge into the sea and it would become one with the sea. So we will merge with God and we will become God. So they were having, Prabhupada was having an argument. And this is the first time I ever heard Prabhupada raise his voice. One of these men was reading from Dr. Mishra's book about this bubble becoming the sea. And even though it was Dr. Mishra's ashram in Monroe, New York, Prabhupada spoke very, very loudly. It was almost shattering to the ears. He said, "You cannot say that you can become the sea. He said, if you take a gold ring out of a gold mine, it still maintains its own identity as a gold ring, even though it's gold. So it's simultaneously one and different. You understand?" It was so loud. It was almost shaking. Because he wasn't going to allow this impersonalist philosophy to invade the association of this fledgling group of little ducklings of Krishna consciousness that were following him like little children. So then later on, someone was asking Prabhupada, after these men left, "Well, who is this Dr. Mishra anyway?" And Prabhupada said, "Well, once he asked me, he said, 'Can God become a snake?' And I said, 'Yes.' So then he said, 'Then you are my guru.'" So in a very kind of simple way, Prabhupada showed us that Dr. Mishra had accepted him as his guru. And why? Because he'd just spoken one simple Vedic truth, that God can take any form, do anything he wants. And on that simple truth, this man, because it's still a custom among Indian people sometimes, if he hears a higher truth, he says, "Okay, I accept you. You're a greater person than I am." So the idea is that Krishna can do anything. He can manifest himself in a million different forms all at once. And when he manifested himself in 16,000 different forms, that's God, that's Krishna. They all were Krishna in his original form, doing the same thing. So similarly, Lord Chaitanya is a full manifestation of Krishna. He can keep his position in Goloka and still carry on earthly manifestations, which he does in every day of Brahma. So this is definitely the inconceivable point. But this is the nature of God. Once Prabhupada said that Krishna had 16,000 wives, and he had a different pastime going on simultaneously in each of the 16,100 palaces. That is God. That is God. People have no idea what God is. But he can do anything, everywhere, at any time. Anything he wants, he can do. Otherwise, he's not God. Give me an example.
Like somebody, like a beggar is on the street and they say it's the same thing when I give money to them than to a spiritualist. That is a very simple example. Uh-huh. Maybe give away some hints how one can as a devotee maybe understand, for example, somebody comes to the temple and one thinks the other can become a devotee and after 20 months then he realizes, oh, there's not something. So how one can differentiate and feel the spiritual.
Yeah. The example is given of the man who's drowning. If you just take his coat, then the body drowns. So similarly, compassion is based only on mundane understanding. To feed a person when they're hungry, or to clothe someone, maybe one time, or to bring medicine to an afflicted area. That has benefit, certainly has benefit. And it comes under the mode of goodness. And it is good, because we accept the mode of goodness as being what it says as being good. But it's not sudasattva. It's not completely pure, because it may not be something that will help that person on the spiritual path. Someone may be fed by the Salvation Army or some government welfare agency, but that will not start such a person on his path back to Godhead. In fact, it may even possibly in some way prevent him from coming to Krishna consciousness. So therefore, Prabhupada is sometimes critical of what we call mundane welfare work. And if we look across the world and we see, for example, in Ethiopia, and there are other places where there have been great famines and huge amounts of foodstuffs and money have been injected into those regions. And a few people maybe didn't die, but then the next year I remember in Ethiopia after the big We Are the World promotion, there was another famine and the same number of people died. So it was temporary. It helped people's situation, but it was temporary. We also understand from the Vedas that there is a certain amount of suffering and enjoyment that is destined within the imprint of the stars in the hand of everybody, which can't be changed. Only temporarily or slightly it can be changed. So if one has a desire to, if one actually has compassion, which is recommended, compassion is recommended not only by, it's not only a characteristic of Lord Chaitanya, but every devotee has to be so compassionate that he feels, paradukha-dukhi, the sufferings of others as his own sufferings. So Prabhupada once said, he said, when I think, I was with him in his room in San Francisco in 1967, he said, when I think of how much people are suffering in this world, it makes me cry. And I'm looking at it kind of quizzically. And he said, no, he said, I actually cry. So that's compassion for suffering. A spiritualist, he feels bad when other people are suffering. A materialist feels good when other people are suffering. And he feels bad when other people are happy. So spiritualist, he actually feels, even those material sufferings, as he feels very bad. He feels like they're his own sufferings. And Vasudeva said he wanted to take the sufferings of every living entity. He wanted them to be relieved of their reactions. He would take them all on himself. So a devotee by nature is very compassionate. He doesn't want to see anybody suffer. But he knows that the way to alleviate that suffering is to give them Krishna, at least to let them hear Krishna, or to give them Krishna prasada, at minimum. Because we read in these very mystical statements in this book that if a person just hears once the word Krishna, he'll get a human body in the next lifetime. Or even once taste prasadam, he'll start in his path to go back to God. Even if he doesn't know what the prasadam is, even if he doesn't know what the word is, even if he doesn't know it has anything to do with Krishna, it's so beneficial. So beneficial. And we read about Ajamil. He was chanting the name of Narayan without thinking of Krishna specifically. But because he was not envious, it evoked all his original understanding. So he became Krishna conscious. So there's different ways to understand this. But if we understand what real compassion is, that it's saving the soul, not the body, then we can see, as Prabhupada said, that devotees are the real welfare workers. And especially we were talking about the importance of time, place, and circumstance. I was reading in your paper how Prabhupada said that no one should go hungry within 10 miles of the temple. Prabhupada established that for Kali Yuga, that we can give prasadam to everybody. He started this because he saw some children in Bengal near the temple fighting with dogs over scraps of throwaway prasadam in Mayapur. Children were fighting with dogs over the remnants of foodstuffs. And Prabhupada, according to what I read, he also became so sad he was crying over that, that they were so poor. So at that time he said that no one within 10 miles of the temple should go hungry. And he started this whole prasadam distribution program. So that's the point, that one should know what real compassion is. But at the same time, one feels very sorry for any kind of suffering. We can't alleviate all the suffering on this planet. When Vasudeva Dutt, desire was awarded, Lord Chaitanya liberated the whole universe. But the suffering still continued anyway because of the nature of people to want to be lords of all they survey. But even such people, even those who are want to be the masters, like we were reading about, the false logicians and the students and the other groups that were mentioned, there is great compassion for them. So we try to devise a means to even envelop them in the Krishna conscious mood. Now that might be construed to be somewhat mundane, but it's actually not. Even if we have to use some so-called mundane tactics, like we're giving them food, but it's not really food, it's prasadam. Or we're entertaining them with kirtan on the streets, but it's not really entertaining. It's giving them the time-tested method of devotional service. Or if we go and give them some relief, or we gave clothing to the earthquake victims in Maharashtra. Why was that beneficial? Because they were getting association. They were also getting prasadam. They were getting books. They were hearing the Hare Krishna mantra regularly. So the tendency to alleviate suffering reaches its perfection in spiritual life, if we want to help people, if we actually have that sense of wanting to do good to our fellow human beings, then we can think how to do it with Krishna consciousness. And then this is actually a form of yuktam vairagya. We can engage that propensity of wanting to help improve the condition of life on this planet, the quality of life, by doing it with Krishna consciousness. And then that material compassion, we might say, becomes completely spiritualized, and it becomes spiritual. So the process is to change sattva into sudha-sattva, to change material compassion into spiritual compassion, and to transform our desire to improve the condition of this planet to spiritual knowledge, to a spiritual tactic, we might say, according to the circumstances. And even if we do a very simple, mundane, so-called act, as devotees, it will be seen as a merciful act of God. There's a famous story that there was a fire. This is an actual history, an account, not just a story, and I don't know which part of Australia it occurred, but there was a fire. And someone was trapped on the fourth or fifth story of a building. The fire was coming up. So a group of devotees were there, and they somehow managed to get a big blanket, and they stretched it out and held it underneath this window, and they induced the person up above to jump, and it saved his life. So it became widely known that devotees saved this person's life. Now, if it was just an ordinary group of kids or people that saved his life, that would have also been known. But because it was Hare Krishna devotees who saved a life, that person for the rest of his life remembered that Krishna saved my life, or that Krishna saved my life. And the people that heard about it, many people they read about it in the newspapers, they thought like that. Hare Krishna saved his life. So indirectly they're thinking, Krishna saved his life, the Krishnas, or Krishna saved his life. So even these seemingly mundane acts, they have spiritual benefit. People are getting Agyata Sukriti here in Krishna's name. Prabhupada would also sometimes give the beggars in the holy dhams alms. And you can make advancement by giving them alms, the beggars that stand outside the temple of Krishna Balaram. Because they're all Brijvasis, they're all devotees of Krishna. Maybe not all, but most. So that's another form of doing something on this sudha-sattva platform, but also doing something that might be apparently mundane. So if devotees are recognized as good, caring people, compassionate people, that's actually beneficial for the Hare Krishna movement. We were just talking about this on the way, just before we came here, to some devotees from Zurich who are opening a center in northern France. And they got permission to build a temple that's about 120 hectares of land. So anyway, it's a long story, but just to make it short, a lot of the local people started hearing all these deep, dark rumors about Hare Krishna's doing all these strange things, breaking up families, worshipping turtles and fish, and not having enough sleep, and just saying the same, repeating things over and over again, not using their brains, and all kinds of very, very strange things. So then we started to discuss how, these are local farm village people, how can they can, and then they start hearing these propaganda things. They start gossiping, they hear it from somebody, and then so they don't want us to build the buildings now. Of course, they might not be able to stop us. So we were discussing what to do. And then we sort of came to the conclusion that if we start doing, making friends with them, cutting their grass, trimming their hedges, if there's some person that's too old to go out, we can bring them some prasadam. Just being friendly in a mundane way. Yeah, it's pretty mundane. Maybe helping somebody chop their wood in the winter. But, you know, making a sustained effort to just do some very mundane things, we concluded that this would be the way that they would gradually come to like us and allow us to do all the things and
actually become Krishna conscious. So this is a way that this very kind of mundane sort of compassionate series of acts can over time become transformed into spiritual activity if the devotee sees it that way. If I act towards someone in a way that benefits them, they know I'm a devotee, and they know that this is actually coming from Krishna. It's coming from my spiritual understanding, my spiritual knowledge, spiritual desires and policies of how I should act and interact with other human beings. Then they get great benefit. Then they feel they can actually become enveloped by this ocean, Lord Chaitanya's great inundation. They can become part of it. Anyway, it's kind of a long answer to it. Question. But those are just some thoughts on it. I was once going through the airport in Las Vegas. I was in a big hurry to catch my plane. And I was practically running, almost running. And off in one corner I saw, you know, sometimes you can see things through the periphery of your eye, you don't really see it straight, but you just sort of, you see it over. And I saw a body being wheeled across the carpet of the airport lounge in a stretcher, wheeled by some medics, and there was a bottle of intravenous hanging. It's kind of an old lady, just unconscious. And somehow, as I was walking, it came closer and closer to me, but I thought, well, I didn't think anything. I was just rushing to catch the plane, and as this body came closer to me, I heard some women's voices, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna. I turned around and it was already past me, and there were two devotees, book distributors, in devotee clothes, two ladies wearing white. And they were both chanting into the ear of this lady who was, maybe she was dying, I don't know, but in critical condition with the intravenous. And I thought, wow, how compassionate these devotees are. I mean, who else would give a hoot? Who would care about this dying old lady going through the airport? Who would care? Just want to, you know, didn't care. I was rushing to get in my... And these devotees, they were thinking, we want this person to have an opportunity to hear Krishna before she dies. I was thinking, wow, this is really compassionate. So nice. Just to, you know, hear the devotees chanting. I mean, you could consider it's like a mundane thing, you know, but it's completely spiritual. They were like ministering the last rites in the middle of an airport with thousands of people walking, and they were walking as fast as they could. They were going out to the ambulance. Somebody else had a question? So, yes. It depends on your vision. If we can see how a person can spiritually benefit by our so-called or apparently superficially mundane compassionate act, then it's spiritual. If we're just trying to do it to only for some mundane reason, then it's material. But even if it means we're doing it because we want people to like Krishna conscious devotees, that's spiritual. Because if they even just think, I like this Hare Krishna person, they're thinking Krishna. And not only are they thinking Krishna, they're thinking favorably of Krishna. So that's very good. That's very good. Now, the point is that we have a spiritual basis. Now, other groups, as you mentioned, groups, they don't have a spiritual basis. Because they don't have complete understanding. They don't know who God is. They don't know what devotional service is. They don't know what the Yuga Dharma is. And they're committing all kinds of seva aparads and nama aparads because they're eating meat and so many things. So if they get someone to like them, what's the benefit? You know, like someone who eats meat, kills animals, eats meat. There's no benefit. It's just further entangling someone.
So that's material. But when a devotee does it and sees how the Krishna consciousness movement is going to benefit, that's spiritual. Now, if a devotee forgets about Krishna and does it, then that's also material. As devotee means, not just because I've been rubber-stamped devotee and I took initiation, that's it. It means to be always thinking of Krishna and thinking how Krishna's movement is going to benefit, how I'm personally going to deepen my Krishna consciousness to this act, how that person is going to get Krishna consciousness.
Through the Vedic?
Through
the Vedic marriage, if they're not devotees.
Yeah. If they're not devotees, can they get benefit?
Yes.
In a Vedic marriage?
Yes, through this process.
They can. It's possible to get benefit because any association with the devotee will be beneficial. But it has to be structured or staged in such a way that they understand that there are higher principles of life. They're not just getting rubber stamped. You're married, and we married you in a Vedic fire sacrifice, so now Krishna likes you. It's not like that. But if the devotee who does this marriage or who arranges it cultivates these individuals and tries to give them more and more Krishna consciousness through prasada, through books, through discussion, through association of some kind, then they're going to benefit. So it can be very beneficial. But again, it's in the consciousness of the person who perpetrates, who begins or arranges this. It shouldn't just be some social function. Everything is okay now, and I've got my Hare Krishna marriage, and everything's all right, and then that's the end of it. And they go out and they do simple activities. They should see that the process of a bond in a Vedic Vedic marriage is to gradually, the goal is to become purified, to become free from all sinful activities, and to chant at least 16 rounds every day. That they should try. They should know that that's what the goal of this whole thing is.
Because I met some people, they asked me about our marriages.
Yeah. Christian system.
Christian system or official system,
right.
Or this Standesamt in Deutschland, or such a thing. They said, yes, I'm married, but I don't care. Yes, I can do what I want, actually. They don't recognize this system. So they asked me, what is the difference if they get married through our system? Shall they get some benefit also in the spiritual life or in the material life? I don't know. They put me just such a question.
Actually, these marriages are meant for people who are initiated devotees. That's what we generally will tell people. If you want a Vedic wedding, you've got to be a devotee first. I mean, in some parts of the world, any priest of any religion can sign a marriage document and it can be considered sanctified. Maybe that's in Germany also. And that's not bad. But as I said, if they understand what the goal is, they should try to get some purification. It shouldn't just be indiscriminately done. There should be some ongoing relationship so that the person's Krishna consciousness will increase. And they should actually understand that really these ceremonies are meant for people who are brahminical and who will follow four regulative principles. And they should think about that and then maybe become devotees and then maybe get a Vedic wedding. That's the best. But somehow if a devotee can sign the marriage certificate and cultivate them in future so that they can become more Krishna conscious, that's also good. Yeah, if they have some desire for purification and higher spiritual understanding, then they could conceivably be cultivated. This is a beautiful temple room. Is this designed by the same person that designed the restaurant downstairs? It's beautiful. Looks just like marble. Yes.
Ich wollte wissen, was für eine Kraft im Gebet haben kann für jemand anders, also ob man für jemanden beten soll, wenn ja, in welcher Form man das machen soll. Ich meine, das auch über das Nama-Mantra machen kann.
Should one pray for somebody else and in what form should one also do it?
Yes.
it's appropriate for Vaishnavas to pray for the welfare of others. You can just do it by a simple prayer, saying, "My dear Lord Krishna, please help this person become a devotee and overcome his problems." We try to see everyone as devotee. Krishna says, actually, everybody is a devotee. Manusha Partha Sarvash, everyone follows my path. And Mamai Bhanso Jiva Loke, that's also mentioned in many books, including Bhagavad Gita. It's a text in Bhagavad Gita that everyone is my part and parcel. So we try to see that everyone's actually a devotee, but there's something that is coming between him and Krishna, an obstacle that's blocking his Krishna consciousness. So we want to see that obstacle be removed. So we can pray to Krishna to please remove that obstacle or help this person understand what his obstacle is and try to remove it himself. And we can also pray that, my dear Lord, please give this person a taste for the chanting of the Maha Mantra. Let him hear Hare Krishna and let him chant and get a taste for hearing Hare Krishna. So we can pray in that way. And we can pray, we can chant Hare Krishna and pray for others. That's very good. Because the tendency is for people to just pray for themselves. I want my security and happiness. So part of this idea of compassion is to care so much for others that we will pray to the Lord to save them. That was actually Lord Chaitanya's. Even he's Krishna, but he was acting in such a way that he wanted Krishna to benedict everybody. He was acting as a devotee. And all of the followers of Lord Chaitanya also. They were constantly praying for mercy so that they could alleviate the suffering of all the others. So we have to constantly pray to carry out our dirty duty to serve the Supreme Lord and for the pray for the upliftment of all people. We should constantly pray for the upliftment of all fallen souls. It's a very good quality to do that. But we ourselves, what can we do? But if we ask Krishna to get involved, then he can do anything. He can do things himself, and he can also empower us to do great tasks, difficult things. So those are some of the ways you can pray. And Krishna is very pleased when you pray that. Thank you very much. Good night. And, I'm very happy to see such a wonderful restaurant, a nice temple. Last time I came here, it was just beginning. We were talking about how Prabhupada wanted a lot of restaurants to open all over the world, especially he was in 1977 giving some directives in America. I talked about this the other day. In one letter, he was writing to all GBC, to his secretary. He said, "Now we have enough." This is 1976. He said, "We have enough temples now in America, so don't open any more temples." He said, "I want the GBCs to all get this message. You should just open restaurants for the time being. For the time being, and then more people will come." So it's a nice way to distribute prasadam. So you have what, prasadam now? Or already you had? Huh? Too late. Hari Bol. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Ishan Karan ki jai.